We're a rare breed, but ultimately the people that I've talked to that split their ticket in one way or another do so because of the issues. The assumption that like we're low information voters could not be anything further from the truth.
This is the Politics Podcast from WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along. We're 2 weeks past Election Day, but things have hardly calmed down. An unprecedented transition, eyes turning back to Georgia, and here, some uncertainty. As the canvas has unfolded, that's the term for the official vote tally, we've seen the margins in some North Carolina races grow wider, and others get even tighter. Perhaps most notable, the seat for Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. That's a race between Democratic incumbent Sherry Beasley and Republican challenger Paul Newby. It remains razor thin and likely is heading toward a recount. But most contests are pretty much done deals at this point. At the top of the ticket in 2020, Donald Trump carried the state. Tom Tillis won re-election to the U.S. Senate, and Roy Cooper earned another term as governor. And you don't have to be a political expert to recognize that one of those things is not like the others. Republican, Republican, Democrat. Trump won by more than 80,000 votes, Tillis by nearly 100,000, and Cooper by about 350,000. This tells us that there were thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of voters who split their tickets for Trump and Cooper. It's an odd pairing, though not unusual. The ticket-splitting phenomenon has been at play here for decades. In a bit, we'll explore the state's voting history. First, let's look at how common this split ticket really is in today's political climate.
First, I would say that it's become less common, but it's not extinct.
That's Peter Francia. He's a political science professor at East Carolina University and the director of the ECU Center for Survey Research.
Certainly in the current day that we live in, political polarization is a reality. That has a lot to do with ideological sorting. There was a time where there were such a thing as liberal Republicans, and certainly in the South, it was almost more common than not to have conservative Democrats. And we don't see nearly as much of that. So ticket splitting is certainly on the decline, but you're correct. It is there. And North Carolina in the last two presidential cycles has had this split outcome.
Yep. In 2016, we saw the same result. Trump carried North Carolina while Cooper won the governor's race. And Francia says he was actually more surprised by that election, mainly because Cooper beat out an incumbent, Republican Pat McCrory. And incumbency, according to Francia, can make a big difference.
Yeah, I think incumbency advantage is important. And if the incumbent is popular, then the incumbent is likely to win re-election. So Roy Cooper was in a position to win re-election. The polls were showing that. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that voters thought he was doing a good job. Think about the economy as well. The economy was in a strong position until the coronavirus, of course, and incumbent politicians win re-election. Well, in this case, that would have been Roy Cooper on the Democratic side, and you have Donald Trump on the Republican side. Now, voters were blaming the coronavirus for the bad economy, or they were unhappy with the response of that incumbent politician's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Then you're voting for change. So there may have been voters out there who didn't like Governor Cooper's response. They were in the minority, but they were certainly there, and that might have influenced their vote. And there were certainly, based on the polls, were North Carolinians who were not happy with Trump's response on the virus, and that might have influenced how they voted.
More from Professor Francia in a few. He is right on the mark to talk about the coronavirus as a possible influencer on people's ballots. According to the Pew Research Center, the majority of Americans viewed the pandemic as an important issue going into the election, which makes the Trump-Cooper vote even more of a head-scratcher, because the two are practically opposites in their approach to the pandemic. Cooper holds his regular by-the-books briefings on COVID response updates. Meanwhile, Trump, well, here he is in Lumberton, North Carolina, just before the election.
That's all I hear about now. That's all I hear. Turn on television. COVID, 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 COVID. A plane goes down. 500 people dead. They don't talk about it. COVID, COVID, COVID.
However, most people don't think about just one issue when casting their vote, and the pandemic was perhaps one of the things guiding people's pens as they filled in their ballot bubbles.
It was a back and forth, and when I ultimately did not see much coming out of the Democratic Party, and it ultimately was deliberately made a referendum on Trump, it became exactly that.
This is M. He lives in Eastern Wake County, is Latino, a father of two, a software engineer, and a split-ticket voter. I talked to him earlier this week to hear more about why he went with Trump and Cooper. He was willing to share, but he asked to remain anonymous for our conversation. That's why we're calling him M.
I am setting myself up in a new community, and I don't want to have preconceived notions of who I am or what I believe, even though I'm willing to stand by them. It is something that I don't like to have pre-assumed about me when meeting people. And also, I have many friends who do not know this, and you could call me, quote-unquote, the shy Trump voter.
M is registered unaffiliated, but he says he voted for Bernie Sanders in this year's Democratic primary. And back in 2016, he also voted for Trump and Cooper. However, this time around, he contemplated not voting at all.
But the amount of people that I talked to that said not voting was a vote for the other guy, I said, you know, if it is a binary decision, then, well, I've got to pick one or the other. I think it's pretty obvious that I'm not a fan of either candidate that was put in front of me. But ultimately, I do agree. It was a binary decision.
Have you wavered?
Yes, actually, I have, because it was definitely a lot easier decision on the presidential level in 2016, because I'd say that race was more about the issues. This race was more or less entirely void of issues, and both sides wanted it to be a referendum on Trump. The Biden campaign was trying to make it a referendum on Trump, and Trump was pushing some culture war mess that I didn't particularly agree with. When it devolved away from those issues, when economic policy was no longer being even discussed, I had to revert back to 2016 and rely on these are largely the same people who were going to staff Hillary's administration was largely going to be a lot of the same people who would staff a potential Biden administration. So at that point, I rolled back to the issues, and the 2016 issues were the ones that led me to believe that Trump was more pro-labor and pro-working class than the Democratic ticket was.
It seems to me like the economy and the labor force is the driving issue. You're not necessarily a single issue voter, but that's the biggest thing for you. Is that a fair classification?
That is a primary issue. The economy is definitely first and foremost.
So what is it that Donald Trump demonstrated to you in his first 4 years in office that solidified for you that he was where you wanted him to be, where you were comfortable with him being when it comes to, I think you've used the phrase labor class a couple of times here.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of his governing style and you can say the crowning achievement of his campaign was tax cuts for the wealthy and resulted in a lot of stock buybacks and completely anti-working class and sort of what you'd expect out of a potential Mitt Romney administration had we gotten that. That being said, there's elements of it that I believe are genuine pro-labor, including the immigration protectionism that sort of falls more in line with a Scandinavian type social democracy. The idea is to keep a tighter grip on the labor force, so businesses have to compete more, which is the underlying philosophy, as I understood it, that the 2016 and what most of Trumpism is.
As we think about the last 8 months and how the pandemic has been handled, did the president's handling of that work against your rationale in any way?
Oh, for sure. I definitely thought that he did not handle things well. And like, as he reminded us all, I think the one thing, good thing he did do was shut down travel from China early, but that was it. And I don't think he handled much of anything else well. So like that was part of the reason why I was that sought after undecided voter pretty much up until about an hour that I returned my ballot.
How did you vote?
I did the mail-in ballot, and then I did a drop-off at my early voting center.
So I guess conversely, what did Roy Cooper do here in his first term that encouraged you? Because, to be fair, he hasn't been able to do very much, right?
I definitely, on the side of, let's start off before the pandemic, and we'll talk about the Medicaid expansion, and that's probably the biggest fight that Cooper is involved in. I am wholeheartedly on his side of that, and I think Medicaid expansion is it makes sense considering we're paying extra money to the federal government for not doing it, and we would want to expand these things that help rural communities and poor working class people, but. After the pandemic came, the Forrest Cooper race became about masking and lockdowns versus or regulations and over none. And I am a young father, so I have a newborn child and a 2-year-old. So I like my wife was pregnant through the entire duration of the pandemic. So we were considered a high risk. And still are considered high risk. So I fell on the side of being pro-regulation and pro-masking than not. But that being said, I don't have school-age kids. I have a steady income through all of this. So I understand the instinct to not want that.
So the flip side of it is Donald Trump had a number of these large gatherings I wasn't at any of them this year. Why didn't that work against you when it came to Trump? If it was an important issue for you as it pertained to Cooper?
I didn't think that the individual rallies was something that was large enough to get caught up on, because I would agree I was not a fan of them either. I would not like have found myself at them after COVID, and I would not have done that had I been in his position. That being said, there were bigger issues at stake that I thought that of several rallies or even multiple across the country wasn't necessarily going to be a catalyst on something that was already out of control.
Sure. But I guess that's a fair point. But to take it a step further, I mean, he has not taken it nearly as seriously as some of the Democratic governors, as some of the Republican governors, to be totally fair. So it feels like writ large or in kind of a greater totality, Trump hasn't taken the pandemic as seriously as some other elected officials.
I would completely agree with that. But like, I think the domain of putting in restrictions on people's life lies in the state, whereas the domain of the federal government is to really sign a check and to get relief to the American people. That's the biggest help the federal government could do. And so that's it sort of, in my mind, was a split of responsibilities and powers that drove that.
A few minutes ago, I mentioned that this is not the first time North Carolina has split the vote and gone with a president and governor from separate parties. In fact, since 1980, North Carolina has now done it 7 times. That's out of 11 general elections. Notably, on each occasion, the split has been a Republican presidential candidate and a Democratic gubernatorial candidate. For a little more context, let's turn back to political science professor Peter Francia.
I moved to North Carolina in 2004, and Mike Easley, a Democrat, won rather comfortably in the race for governor. So did George W. Bush, the Republican. Their margins of victory were 13 points each. So Bush won by 13, a Republican, Easley won by 13, a Democrat. So, you know, you can go back to 2004 and find an example. If you keep going back, Mike Easley in 2000 won the governor's race, a Democrat, and the Republicans with George W. Bush won in 2000 as well. If you look at races in the 90s, you have Jim Hunt winning on the Democratic side, and you have Republicans winning with George H.W. Bush in 1992 and Bob Dole in 1996. So if you want to go back even further, 1980, you have Jim Hunt wins in the race for governor, and you have Ronald Reagan carrying North Carolina in 1980. So there are plenty of examples in what I would describe as, you know, fairly recent electoral history.
I love that you mentioned 2004. It's in my notes here, and I was hoping we would get to it, but you already got there. So this year, we have Cooper winning by 4.5, Trump carrying North Carolina by a 1.3, I think it was just about it, my last check. And again, those numbers are still moving incrementally. So those are relatively tight margins. You mentioned 2004, and George W. Bush wins by upwards nearly 13 points. Mike Easley wins re-election by nearly 13 points. Can I deduce that we had many, many more ticket splitters 16 years ago?
There were definitely more ticket splitters in 2004. And that's been the pattern, though, that there's been a decline. So we did see it in 2020, and there was just enough of it to give us, in a close election, two different outcomes. But ticket splitting was certainly more common if you go back a decade or two or three or four and keep going back. In fact, it was almost the norm for much of the South to vote Republican at the presidential level, you know, 1968 and after, and then vote for Democrats at the local level.
So I guess let's build on the history of ticket splitting. What would you say we've generally seen across the last 20 years in terms of more or less? And if you want to contextualize that to the American South or the nation, both would be great.
Yeah, I mean, so ticket splitting is much, much less common. And again, that's due to partisan polarization, which is at its, you know, at highs that it hasn't been at. You know, you have to almost go back to the Civil War to find polarization as high as it is today. And that's made ticket splitting less common. So again, there's less of it, but it's not extinct. And I've pointed to earlier, there are issues that voters look at that may be local or ones that affect your specific state. And then there are a different set of issues that are there nationally. So elections are not just simply about the incumbent candidate. Voters do have a choice. And so the quality of the opposition can matter. Voters may simply feel at one level of office that there are two viable candidates, but maybe at a different level of office, the challenger to the incumbent is perhaps very weak, and you know, they're more comfortable with what they have. So quality of opposition is something that can vary from race to race. Money in politics is another factor. Money doesn't guarantee victory in a political election, but it's certainly a contributing factor. So you have to look at some of those factors as well.
So a loaded, odd, kind of tangential question to end on here, but as I think about ticket splitting, you mentioned the U.S. Senate. I can't help but be motivated to ask you at least something about Georgia as we head to these two special elections in early January. A number of people have asked me in the last week or so, hey, you know, what do you think of Georgia? What do you think of Georgia? And my initial response, and I am not an analyst and not a political scientist, but my initial response is that's a heavy lift. That it's from the Democratic perspective, it's a heavy lift for Democrats to win these two races come January. But give me just the 10,000 foot view from your perspective on Georgia in the next 2 months.
Yeah, and I've been giving this a lot of thought because the nation's attention is going to, if it hasn't already turned to Georgia, it certainly is about to because of how important those two Senate seats are. If the Democrats, of course, win both of those races, they'll control the U.S. Senate. They still will have their majority in the House, and Biden will be in the White House, and Harris is the VP. So That's a big deal because there'd be unified government. But your question about what to expect, this is what we know about runoff elections in Georgia. Runoff elections in Georgia have historically been older and more conservative. If that holds, then Republicans are likely to win one, perhaps both those Senate races, and all they need to do is win one. So if history is any guide, then there's a very, very good chance that the Republicans will control the United States Senate because they will get at least one win in Georgia, if not win both. I think the wild card in all of this is that Georgia did just flip from Republican to Democrat at the presidential level. And a lot of folks are giving, I think, just credit to Stacey Abrams and the voter turnout machine that she built to get voters out for Joe Biden. If Stacey Abrams and the Democrats in Georgia can replicate what they were able to do in the presidential election, you know, then perhaps we'll be talking about Georgia in a very different way after those Senate races. But again, if history is the guide, then Republicans have to feel good about their chances of maintaining a majority in the United States Senate.
Peter Francia is a professor of political science at East Carolina University and the director of the ECU Center for Survey Research. He spoke with us via Zoom from his home. This episode was produced by the trusty and talented Charlie Shelton Ormond. My name is Jeff Tiberi. We'll visit your podcast feeds again on Friday for a review of North Carolina political news. Until then, hope you enjoy your week.